Timescape, Cassette 8.
Saul Schriffer called in mid-July. He had finished up the observations of 99 Hercules using the Green Bank radio telescope. Results were negative. No coherent signal rose up out of the interstellar sputter. Gordon suggested using higher frequencies and narrower bandwidths. Saul said he had tried some. Without more to show for their efforts, though, he wasn't going to be able to get any more time on the instrument. Conventional research projects had precedence. They talked for a few minutes about alternatives, but there weren't any. The Cavendish group had turned down Saul's request for telescope time. Saul said a few reassuring things, and Gordon mechanically agreed. When Saul hung up, Gordon felt an unexpected letdown. He saw that, without admitting it to himself, he had been pinning hope on the radio listening idea. That evening, when he met Penny for dinner at Buzzy's, he did not mention the call. The next day, he wrote Saul a letter asking that he not publish any summary of the radio search. Let's wait until something positive comes along, he argued. But more than that, Gordon wanted to keep quiet. Maybe it would all go away. Maybe it would be forgotten. When Penny went board surfing at Scripps Beach, Gordon sat on the sand and watched. He had been doing a lot of that recently, sitting, thinking, letting others play out the summer. He liked running on the beach and knew he should try riding the waves now that he had someone to teach him, but something held him back. He watched the La Jolla ladies work on their expensive tans and came to know the types. People who worked outdoors were pale behind the knees, whereas beach loungers were a uniform chocolate, a consummation carefully arrived at. Penny came out of the tumbling waters, board perched on a hip, straggly hair dripping. She sagged down beside him, wrung out her hair, flicked a glance at his set expression.
Okay, she said finally. Time to fess up.
Fess who?
Fess Parker. Gordon, come on. You're doing your zombie imitation.
Gordon had always prided himself on getting right to the point, but now he found himself rummaging for something to say. You know, I've been looking through the journals in the library. Astronomy journals, I mean. Mercury, Scientific American, Science News. Most of them are flat-out ignoring Saul's PR work. Even if they mention it, they don't reproduce the picture. And not a one gave the Hercules coordinates. Publish them yourself. Gordon shook his head. Won't do any good.
When did you start feeling so inadequate?
At 10, Gordon said, hoping for some way to deflect this conversation. When I began to suspect I wasn't Mozart.
Uh-huh.
I was that American myth. The 98-pound weakling. Those Charles Atlas ads, remember? When I went to the beach, bullies didn't kick sand in my face. They'd kick me in the face. Eliminate the middleman.
Uh-huh.
She studied him, face compressed.
You know, that was the first thing you've told me about the Saul business in, what, a month?
He shrugged.
You never tell me anything anymore.
I don't want you to get so involved that people will ask you about it, so you'll have to defend me to friends. He paused. Or deal with cranks.
Gordon, I'd rather know what's going on. Really, if I'm to talk to UCLJ people, I can't very well gloss over it.
He shrugged again. Big deal. I might be leaving UCLJ anyway.
What?
So he told her about not getting the merit increase. Look, he concluded, being appointed an assistant professor is always risky. You may have to move on if things don't work out. I outlined all that to you. We talked it over.
Well, sure, eventually.
She stared off toward La Jolla Point, face blank.
I mean, in the long run, if you didn't publish...
I've published, he murmured in a half-breath, defensively.
Then why?
The business with Lakin. I can't do research in a group with two guys I like, Fair and Schultz, and one I rubbed the wrong way, Lakin.
Personalities are... I thought scientists rose above mere squabbling. You told me that once.
This is more than a squabble. Can't you see that?
Huh.
Lakin is kind of out of the old school. Skeptical. Thinks I'm trying to deliberately make trouble for him. He ticked off motivations on his fingers. Getting older and feeling a little shaky, maybe? Hell, I don't know. But I can't work in a group dominated by a guy like that. I've told you that before.
Ah.
Her voice had a brittle edge.
So, in effect, we talked that one out, too.
Oh, Christ.
Well, I'm glad you're conferring with me on all these problems. On your problems.
Look. He spread his hands, a wide gesture. I don't know what I'll do. I was just talking.
It'll mean leaving La Jolla. Leaving California, where I've lived all my life.
If that comes up, give me a few minutes to mull it over, okay?
Sure.
Sure.
You can still stay on here, though? It's your choice?
Yeah. We'll decide it together.
Good. Fair and square? Open? No holding yourself aloof?
One man, one vote.
That's what I'm afraid of.
One person, one vote.
Zappo.
Gordon lay down and opened a wrinkled Time magazine against the hovering sun. He tried to dismiss the boiling alternatives in his head and concentrate on a piece in the science section on the planned Apollo moonshots. He made progress slowly. A decade of reading the close-packed language of physics had robbed him of speed. On the other hand, it did make him more conscious of style. He was gradually coming to feel that the breezy simplicities of time hid more than they revealed. He was mulling this point when a shadow fell over him.
"Thought I recognized you,"
a gruff man's voice said. Gordon blinked up into the hazy sunshine. It was Cliff, in a bathing suit and carrying a six-pack of beer. Gordon became very still. "I thought you lived in Northern California."
"Hey, Cliffy!"
Penny had rolled over and seen him.
"What you doing here?"
She sat up. Cliff squatted on the sand, eyeing Gordon.
"Just walking along. My day off. Got a job in Oceanside."
"And you saw us here?"
Penny said happily.
"How long have you been down this way? You should have called me."
"Yes," Gordon said dryly.
"A remarkable coincidence."
"A little over a week. Got me a job in 2 days flat."
Cliff hunkered down, not sitting on the sand, but resting with the beer in both hands between his legs and his buttocks only an inch from the beach. Gordon remembered seeing Japanese perched like that for hours in a movie somewhere. It was a curious pose, as though Cliff did not wish to commit himself to fully sitting with them. Penny burbled on, but Gordon was not listening. He studied Cliff's sun-baked ease and looked for something behind the eyes, something that explained the improbable coincidence. He did not believe it for an instant, of course. Cliff knew that Penny surfed, and this was the nearest good beach. The only interesting question was whether Penny had known this was going to happen as well. There was no sign between them. No small, inexplicable smiles. No gestures. No false notes that Gordon could see. But that was just it. He wasn't good at that sort of thing. And as he watched them talking with their slow and easy grace, they seemed so alike. So familiar from 1,000 movies and cigarette ads, and so strange. Gordon sat, white as the underbelly of a fish in comparison, a flabby, dirty alabaster with black swirls of hair. He felt a slow flush of emotion, a wash of feeling he could not quite name. He did not know if this was some elaborate, cute game they were playing, but if it was, Gordon surged up. Lurched to his feet. Penny watched him. Her lips parted in surprise at his stony expression. He struggled for the words, for something to fill the ground between knowledge and suspicion, something just right, and finally mumbled,
Don't mind me.
Hey, sport, I...
Goy games. Gordon waved a hand in dismissal, face hot. It had come out more bitter than he planned.
"Gordon, come on, really?"
Penny began, but he turned away and broke into a trot. The rhythm picked him up instantly. He heard her voice, raised above the crunch of breakers, but it was thin and fading as she called to him. "Okay," he thought. "No Great Gatsby finish, but it got me out of that..." Not ending the sentence, not wanting to think about any of it anymore, he ran toward the distant carved hills. Chapter 27, August 6th, 1963. I'm thinking of going into industry, he said to Penny one evening over supper. They had shared their small talk already in what had become a thin ritual. Gordon refused to discuss the meeting on the beach, refused to have Cliff over for a drink, and felt his withdrawal would, ultimately, settle the matter. Only dimly did it occur to him that the refusals were the cause of the curiously stale conversations they now had together.
What's that mean?
Work in a company research lab. GE, Bell Labs. He launched into an advertisement for the virtues of working where results counted, where ideas evolved swiftly into hardware. He did not, in fact, believe the industrial labs were superior to university groups, but they did have an aura. Things got done faster there. Helpers and technicians abounded. Salaries were higher. And, too, he enjoyed the unavoidable smugness of the scientist who knew he could always have a life beyond academe. Not merely a job, but a pursuit. Genuine research, and for decent pay, too. Maybe something beyond the laboratory as well. Look at Herb York with his consulting on defense posture and the cloudy theories of disarmament. The government could use some clear scientific thinking there, he argued.
Gordon, this is just plain old bullshit.
Huh? It stalled him for a moment.
You don't want to go to work for a company?
I'm thinking very seriously.
You want to be a professor. Do research. Have students. Give lectures. You lap it up.
I do?
Of course you do. When everything's going okay, you get up humming in the morning, and you're humming when you come home at night.
You overestimate the pleasures of the job.
I'm not estimating at all. I see what professoring does to you.
Huh. His momentum blunted, he ruefully admitted to himself that she knew him pretty well.
So instead of taking up some temporary escape hatch like industry, you ought to be doing something.
Like what?
Something different. Move your X's and Y's and Z's around. Try
another approach, he finished for her.
Exactly. Thinking about problems from a different angle is...
She broke off, hesitated, then plunged ahead.
Gordon, I could tell what was going on there with Cliff. I could reassure you and do a whole routine, but I'm not sure anymore that you'd believe me.
Huh.
Remember this, she said firmly. You don't own me, Gordon. We're not even married, for Christ's sake.
Is that what's bothering you?
Bothering me? God, it's you!
Because if it is, maybe we ought to talk about that and see...
Gordon, wait. When we started out, moved in together, we agreed we were going to try it out. That's all.
Sure, sure. He nodded vigorously, his food forgotten. But I'm willing. If it's making you play games like this thing with Cliff, and... That was really childish, Penny, arranging that meeting, just... childish. I'm willing to talk about it, you know, getting... Penny held out her hand, palm toward him.
No. Wait. 2 points, Gordon.
She ticked them off.
One, I didn't arrange any meeting. Maybe Cliff was looking for us, but I didn't know about it. Hell, I didn't even know he was around here. Two, Gordon, do you think our getting married will solve anything?
Well, I feel that...
Because I don't want to, Gordon. I don't want to marry you at all.
He came up out of the muggy press of late summer in the subway and emerged into the only slightly less compacted heat of 116th Street. This entrance and exit were relatively new. He dimly remembered an old cast-iron kiosk, which, until the early 50s, ushered students into the rumbling depths. It stood between two swift lanes of traffic, providing a neat Darwinian selection pressure against undue mental concentration. Here, students with their minds stuffed chock-full of Einstein and Mendel and Hawthorne often had their trajectories abruptly altered by Hudsons and DeSotos and Fords. Gordon walked along 116th Street, glancing at his watch. He had refused to give a seminar on this, his first return to his alma mater, since receiving his doctorate. Still, he did not want to be late for his appointment with Claudia Zins. She was a kindly woman who had barely escaped Warsaw as the Nazis were entering it, but he remembered her impatience with late students. He hurried by South Field. To his left, students clustered on the shallow steps of Low Library. Gordon headed for the physics building, perspiring from the effort of carrying his big brown suitcase. Among a knot of students, he thought he saw a familiar face.
"David! Hey, David!" he called.
But the man turned away quickly and walked in the opposite direction. Gordon shrugged. Maybe Selig didn't want to see an old classmate. He always had been an odd bird. Come to think of it, everything here now seemed a little bit odd, like a photograph of a friend with something retouched. In the yellow summer light, the buildings looked a little more scruffy, the people wan and pale, the gutters slightly deeper in trash. A block away, a drunk lounged on a doorstep, drinking from something in a brown paper bag. Gordon picked up his pace and hurried inside. Maybe he had been in California too long. Everything that wasn't crisp and new struck him as used up. Claudia Zins was unchanged. Behind her warm eyes lurked a glinting intelligence, distant and amused. Gordon spent the afternoon with her, describing his experiments, comparing his apparatus and techniques with her laboratory. She knew of spontaneous resonance and Saul Schriffer and the rest. She found it interesting, she said, the standard word that committed you to nothing. When Gordon asked her to try to duplicate the experiment with Cooper, at first she brushed aside the idea. She was busy. There were many students. The time on the big nuclear resonance magnets was all booked up. There was no money. Gordon pointed out how similar one of her present setups was to his own. Simple modifications would make it identical. She argued that she didn't have a sample of indium antimonide good enough. He produced 5 good samples, little slabs of gray. Here, use them any way you want. She arched an eyebrow. He found himself slipping into a persona he had forgotten. Pushy Yid schoolboy, hustling the teacher for a better grade. Claudia Zins knew these routines as well as anybody living, but gradually his pressure piqued her interest. Maybe there was something to the spontaneous resonance effect after all. Who could tell, now that the waters around it had been muddied so? She gazed at him with the warm brown eyes and said, "It's not for that you want me to check, not to clear up this mishmash." And he nodded yes. He hoped she would find something else. But, a warning finger, let the curves speak for themselves. He smiled and made little jokes and felt a little eerie living in his student persona again, but somehow it all came together and worked. Claudia Zins slipped from maybe and if to when, and then seemingly without noticing the transition, she was scheduling some time on the NMR rig in September and October. She asked after some of his classmates, where they were, what sort of jobs. He saw suddenly that she had a true affection for the young people who passed through her hands and out into the world. As she left, she patted his arm, brushed some lint from his damp summer jacket. As he walked away across South Field, he remembered the undergraduate awe that ran through him in those first 4 long, hard years. Columbia was impressive. Its faculty was world-famous. The buildings and laboratories imposing. Never had he suspected that the place might be a mill grinding out intelligent trolls, willing and able to wire the circuits, draw the diagrams, to spin the humming wheels of industry. Never had he thought that institutions could stand or fall because of the vagaries of a few individuals, a few uninspected biases. Never. Religions do not teach doubt. He took a taxi cross town. The cab banged into potholes on some of the side streets, a jarring contrast with California's smooth boulevards. He was just as glad Penny had refused to come. The city wasn't at its best on the grill of August. They had been tense with each other since the marriage thing came up. Maybe a short separation would help. Let the whole subject drift downstream into the past. Gordon watched the blur of faces going by outside. There was an earthen hum here, like the sound the IRT made going onto Broadway. The hollow, heavy rumble seemed to him strangely threatening, with its casual reminder of other people going about their other lives, totally ignorant of nuclear magnetic resonance and enigmatic suntan Californians. His obsessions were merely his, not universal. And he realized that every time he tried to focus on Penny, his mind skittered away into the safe recesses of the spontaneous resonance muddle. So much for being captain of his fate. He got out of the cab into the street where he grew up, blinking in the watery sunlight. Same beat-up trash cans adding their perfume, same grill work, same Grundweiss grocery down the corner. Dark-eyed young housewives toting bags, herding their chattering children. The women were conservatively dressed, the only hint of undercurrents being their broad, lipstick, sensuous mouths. Men in gray business suits hurrying by, black hair cropped short. His mother was on the landing, arms spread wide as he came up. He gave her a good son kiss. When he came into the old living room with its funny, close flavors, "It's in the furniture, the stuffing. It's with us for life," she said, as though the stuffing was immortal. It washed over him. He decided to just let everything go. Let her tell him the months of carefully stored gossip, show the engagement pictures of distant relatives, cook him a good home meal for once, chopped liver and kugel and flunken. They listened to calypso rhythms on the ancient brown Motorola in the corner. Later they went down to see the Grundweisses. "He tells me 3 times, bring that boy down. I'll give him an apple, like before." And around the block, hailing friends, discussing seriously the statistics of earthquakes, heaving a softball into the waning summer light for a bunch of kids playing in a lot. The next day, just from that one throw, can you believe it? His arm was sore. He stayed 2 days. His sister came over, cheerful and busy and oddly calm. Her dark eyebrows moved with each arch of a sentence, each surge of her face, making dancing parentheses. Friends dropped by. Gordon went all the way over to 70th Street to get some California wine for these occasions, but he was the only one who drank more than a glass. Still, they talked and joked with as much animation as any La Jolla cocktail party, proving alcohol an unnecessary lubricant. Except his mother. She ran out of neighborhood news soon enough and then relied on his friends or his sister to carry the conversation. Alone with him, she said little. He found himself slowly drawn into this vacuum. The apartment had been thick with talk as he grew up, except in the last times of his father, and the silence here unnerved him. Gordon told his mother about the battle over his work, of Saul Schriffer. No, she had not seen the TV news, but she heard. She wrote him, remember? Of spontaneous resonance, of Tulare's warning, and finally, of Penny. His mother didn't, wouldn't, couldn't believe a girl would turn down a man like her son. What could you be thinking of to do that? Gordon found this response unexpectedly pleasing. He had forgotten the ability of mothers to shore up sons' egos. He confessed to her that somehow he had gotten to the habit of thinking he and Penny would settle into something more conventional. Respectable, his mother corrected. It had come as a surprise that Penny wasn't thinking in parallel. Something had happened to him then. He tried to explain it to his mother. She made the familiar, encouraging sounds. Maybe, I don't know, it was Penny I wanted to hold on to, now that everything else is going kaput. But that wasn't quite what he meant either. He knew the words were false as soon as they were out. His mother picked up on them, though. So she doesn't know what's what? This is a surprise? I tried to tell you that. Gordon shook his head, sipping tea, confused. It was no use, he saw. He was all jumbled up inside, and he suddenly didn't want to talk about Penny anymore. He started on the physics again, and his mother clattered the spoons and teapot with fresh energy, smiling. Good work, yes, that's good for you now. Show her what she's lost by... And on she went, longer than Gordon wanted. He felt a momentum building in him, an urgency. He veered from these muddy matters of women. As his mother's voice droned in the heavy air, he thought about Claudia Zins. He shuffled numbers and equipment in his head. He was making some plans when her phrases gradually penetrated. She thought he was leaving Penny.
Huh?
He sputtered. And she said blankly, "Well, after that girl rejected you." An argument followed. It reminded him far too much of the debates over when he had to be home from dates and what he wore and all the other small things that finally drove him to an apartment of his own. It ended with the same sad shaking of the head.
"You are fatushed, Gordon. Fatushed."
He changed the subject, wanted to call up Uncle Herb. "He's in Massachusetts. He bought a consignment of hats cheap, now goes up there to spread them around. The market fell kapush when Kennedy wouldn't wear one, you know, but your uncle figures in New England, the men, their heads are cold." She made more tea. They went for a walk. The silences widened between them. Gordon made no attempt to bridge them. His mother was a boil over Penny, he could see that, but he'd had enough. He could stay longer, but the spreading silences promised more trouble. He stayed overnight, took her to an off-Broadway play, and topped it off with crepes at Henry VIII's. The next morning, he caught the 8:28 United for the coast. Chapter 28, August 12th, 1963. Cooper looked doubtful.
"You think this is enough?"
"For now, yeah. Who knows?" Gordon shrugged. "Maybe for good, too.
I at least ought to fill in some of the high-field observations."
"Not that important."
"After what that committee did to me, I want to be sure..."
"More data isn't the answer. You need more background reading, more analysis of your data, things like that. Not more numbers churning out of the lab."
"You sure?"
"You can close out your run by tomorrow."
Well, okay."
In reality, Cooper could probably strengthen his case with more data. Gordon had always disliked the practice of over-measuring every effect, though, mostly because he suspected it deadened the imagination. After a while, you saw only what you expected to see. How could he be sure Cooper was really taking all the data as it came? This was a justifiable reason for bumping Cooper off the NMR rig, but that wasn't why Gordon did it. Claudia Zins would be starting up in September. If she found anything anomalous, Gordon wanted to be running simultaneously. Gordon came home from the lab hungry. Penny had already eaten and was watching the 11 o'clock news. "Want anything?" he called from the kitchen.
"No."
"What's that you're watching?"
"March on Washington."
"Huh?"
"Martin Luther King, you know."
He hadn't been paying any attention to the news. He asked nothing more. Discussing politics with Penny would only set her off. She had been elaborately casual since he had returned. There was an odd truce between them, not a peace. "Hey," he called, coming into the living room, which was lit only by the pale electric glow of the TV.
"Dishwasher won't go on."
"Uh-huh." She didn't turn her head. "Did you call?"
"No, you for once."
"I did last."
"Well, I'm not. Hate that. Let it be broke."
"You spend more time with it than me."
"That'll change, too."
"What?"
"Not busting ass to fix meals anymore."
"Didn't think you had."
"How'd you know? You couldn't fry butter."
2 points off for credibility, he said lightly. "You know I can cook some things, anyway."
"Come on."
"I'm serious," he said sharply. "I'm going to be in the lab a lot, and..."
Loud and prolonged applause.
"For Christ's sake.
I won't be here much, so..."
"Neither will I, except in and out."
"At least you're doing something now."
"Crap, that's not what you're on the rag about."
"Metaphorical rag?
Real rag? Meta-whatever rag? How do I know?"
"I thought you thought maybe real rag. Otherwise, maybe you would have touched me since you got back."
"Oh.
Didn't notice, huh?"
Grimly. "I noticed."
"Okay, why?"
"Wasn't thinking about it, I guess."
"Think about it.
You know, busy."
"Think I don't know?"
"Come on, Gordon, I saw your face when you got off that plane.
We're going to have a drink at the El Cortez, look at the city, lunch.
Okay, look, I need dinner.
You dinner, I'll watch the speech.
Good.
Wine? Sure. Enough for later?
Later?
My mother should have taught me to be more direct. Later, when we fuck.
Oh, yes. Fuck we will.
They did. It wasn't very good.
Gordon broke Cooper's experiment down to the basic components. Then he rebuilt it. He checked each piece for shielding, looking for any way an unsuspected signal could get into the circuitry. He had most of it reassembled when Saul Schriffer appeared, unannounced, in the lab.
Gordon, I was just at UCLA and I thought I'd drop by.
Oh, hi, Gordon murmured, wiping his hands on an oily cloth. A man with a camera followed Saul into the lab.
This is Alex Petersky from Life. They're doing a piece on exobiology.
I'd appreciate a few shots, Petersky said.
Gordon murmured, yeah, sure, and Petersky quickly brought in reflecting screens and camera gear. Saul talked about the reaction to his announcement.
Dreadful example of closed minds, Saul said. Nobody is following up our lead. I can't get anyone in the astronomical community to give the idea 5 seconds.
Gordon concurred and decided not to tell Saul about Claudia Zins. Petersky circled them, clicking and bobbing.
Turn this way a little more, eh?
And Saul would do as directed. Gordon followed suit, wishing he wore something more than a t-shirt and jeans. This was, of course, the one day he had not worn his usual slacks and Oxford broadcloth.
Great, gentlemen, just great,
Petersky said in conclusion. Saul inspected the experiment a moment. Gordon showed him some preliminary warm-up traces he'd taken. Sensitivity was low, but the curves were obviously clean resonance lines.
Too bad. More results could open this whole thing up again, you know.
Saul studied him.
Let me know if you see anything, okay?
Don't hold your breath.
No, I suppose not.
Saul appeared momentarily dejected.
I really thought there was something to it, too.
Maybe there is.
Yes, yes, of course. Perhaps there is. He brightened. Don't get the idea that it's all over, eh? When it's died out a little and people have stopped hooting with laughter at the very idea, well, it'll make a good article. Maybe something for Science, titled Tilting at Orthodox Windmills. Well, that might go over.
Uh-huh.
Well, Alex and I have to be off. We're going up through Escondido to Palomar.
Doing some observing there? Gordon asked casually.
No, I don't do the observations, you know. I'm more of an idea man. Alex wants to take some pictures, that's all. It's an awesome place.
Oh, yes. In a moment, they were gone, and he could get back to his experiment. The first day Gordon got the NMR rig back on the air, there were signal-to-noise problems. On the second day, stray leakage waves clouded the results. One of the indium antimonide samples acted funny, and he had to cycle the rig down, dump the cold bath, and pull the defective sample. That took hours. Only on the third day did the resonance curves begin to look right. They were reassuringly accurate. They fit theory quite well, within the crossbars of experimental error. Beautiful, Gordon thought. Beautiful and dull. He kept the rig running all day, in part to be sure the electronics stayed stable. He found he could take care of ordinary business, coaching Cooper, making up lecture notes for the coming semester, cutting the tiny gray indium antimonide bars on the hot wire oil immersion setup, and duck into the lab for a quick NMR measurement every hour or two. He settled into a routine. Things got done. The curves remained normal.
Professor Bernstein?
The woman said, her voice pitched high and grating. He wondered idly if her accent was Midwestern.
Yes?
He said into the telephone.
This is Adele Morrison with Senior Scholastic Magazine. We are doing a major piece on the, claim you and Professor Schriffer have made. We are treating it as an example of controversy in science. I wondered...
Why?
Pardon?
Why bring it up? I prefer you just forgot about it.
Well, Professor Bernstein, I don't know. Professor Schriffer was most cooperative. He said he thought our readership, which is high school seniors, you know, would learn a great deal from such a study.
I'm not so sure of that.
Well, Professor, I'm afraid I'm only an assistant editor here. I don't make policy. I believe the article is, yes, here. It's already in galley form. It's mostly an interview with your colleague, Professor Schriffer.
Uh-huh. The voice rose higher.
I was asked to see if you had any final comment on the status of the controversy. We could add it to the galleys now if...
No, nothing to say.
You're sure? The editor asked me to...
I'm sure. Let it go as is.
Well, all right. We have several other professors quoted in the article, and they make some very critical comments. I thought you should know that.
For a moment, it tempted him. He could ask their names and listen to the quotations and frame some reply. The woman was waiting, the phone spitting the faint hiss of long distance. He blinked. She was good. She'd almost hooked him into it. No, they can say what they like. Let Saul carry this one. He hung up. Let the scholastic seniors of this great nation think whatever they wanted. He only hoped the article wouldn't increase the rate of crank visits. The summer sun bleached everything into a flatness stripped of perspective. Penny came in from surfing and plopped down beside Gordon.
Too many wipeouts, she explained. Riptide, too. Kept sucking me into the pilings.
Running is a lot safer, he observed.
And boring.
But not worthless.
Maybe. Oh, that reminds me. I'm going up to see my parents sometime soon. I'd go before classes, but Dad is off on some business trip.
What reminded you of that?
Huh? Oh, well, you said running wasn't worthless, and I remember that I had a student last semester who used the longest word in the English language deliberately in a paper I was grading.
It's floxinocini hilipilification. It means the act of estimating as worthless.
Really?
Yeah, and I had to look the damn thing up. It isn't in any American dictionary, but I found it in the Oxford English. And? Well, that's the dictionary my daddy gave me. Gordon smiled and lay back on the sand, hoisting an Esquire up to blot out the sun. You're a highly non-linear lady. Whatever that means. It's a compliment, believe me.
Well?
Well, what? Do you want to go up to Oakland with me or not?
That's what this is about?
Despite your attempts to avoid it, yes.
Attempts to...
Penny, you've been reading too much Kafka.
Yes, sure, I'll go.
When?
How should I know? It's your trip, your parents.
She nodded. An odd, pinched expression appeared on her face, then vanished. Gordon wondered what she was feeling, but he knew no simple way to ask. He opened his mouth to begin a fumbling approach, and then gave up. Was going to Oakland part of the courtship dance? Taking the boy home to be viewed? Maybe that was only an East Coast phenomenon. He wasn't sure. After announcing that she didn't want to marry him and then staying on and living with him as though things would just keep going that way, Penny had become an utter mystery to him. Gordon sighed to himself, giving up on the whole subject. He read for a few minutes and then said,
"Hey, it says here the test ban treaty is in effect."
"Sure," Penny murmured, rolling over from her drowsy sleep in the sun. "Kennedy signed it months ago. I must have missed it." Gordon thought of Dyson and Orion, a strangely appealing dream that was now dead. Nobody was going to get out to the planets right away. The space program would limp along on liquid fuel rockets. It struck Gordon that the times were pressing in now. New ideas and new people were coming into the old La Jolla of Chandler's day. The same Kennedy who had pushed the test ban and killed Orion was also federalizing the Alabama National Guard,
to stop George Wallace from using them against the desegregation program. Medgar Evers had been killed just a few months before. There was a feeling running through the country now that things had to change. Gordon tossed the magazine aside. He rolled over beneath the sun's broiling and began to doze off. A sea breeze brought a sour reek of the rotting kelp bank farther down the beach. He wrinkled his nose. The hell with the press of the times. Politics is for the moment, Einstein said once. An equation is for eternity. If he had to choose sides, Gordon was on the side of the equations.
This ends side one of cassette 8. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.